Okay, so we're moving on from clustering to I/O now, and we'll be looking at how we used NIO2 inside Tomcat and how we actually did some improvements to NIO2 in the process. So I'm Rémi Mocherat, I work at Red Hat, and I've been a Tomcat committer for some time now, since 2000. I've been elected an ASF member in 2002, I think. It's been a while now. So first, we'll start with a presentation on what NIO2 is exactly. Then, since, well, we have to encrypt everything now, we'll look at how to use SSL with NIO2, since it's a bit different from NIO. Then we'll discuss the problems we run into while experimenting with NIO2, how we extended it to solve those problems as much as possible. Then we look in detail at how we used NIO2 inside Tomcat, like what components we rewrote using it, stuff like that. And last, we'll look at how you can use NIO2 inside your own web apps. Okay, so first, introduction about NIO2. So basically, it was introduced in Java 7. So the first version which actually could use the first Tomcat version which actually could use NIO2 was Tomcat 8.0, since it depended on Java 7. So internally, it's all non-blocking API. Basically, all the read and write calls you're making will never block. They're either complete or fail. Unlike NIO, the main big difference is that you don't have to write the socket pulling code. Basically, it's all abstracted inside an asynchronous API. In addition to the asynchronous API, it also exposes some blocking style semantics, which we'll look about. It's very handy in some cases. Last, it's a very fancy API with lots of objects, very verbose, and really fancy all sort of sugar. It's pretty cool. All right, so first, the asynchronous read and write. Basically, they're all non-blocking, so either it will complete, and then you'll get a completion handler call. I have my gadget. A completion handler call later when the operation is done, or if some operation was already going on the socket, like, for example, if you have a read operation going on and you try to read again the socket, and the first read didn't complete yet, you'll get a pending exception. So no concurrency at all. Then you have the blocking API. Basically, it's a simple read and write API that returns a future object. And then you can call get on that future, either without a timeout or with a timeout. You should use the timeout. And then basically, it will block until the operation is complete or fails. Also, same as with the asynchronous version, if you have concurrency, like if you have some future going on, like you did the read, for example, and it didn't complete yet, if you try to read again, it will produce an exception. Same for write. Okay, in addition to that, you also have the asynchronous calls that do vectored I/O. Basically, you can read and write to and from multiple buffers. So in single call, will translate into a single I/O call into the OS, and it will read and write to multiple buffers. It's obviously more complex to use, and evidently it's pretty handy with fixed length binary protocol. For example, if you have a protocol which have a fixed length header, you could use a buffer with that length, and then another buffer with some arbitrary length, and basically, if you give those two buffers to a read, the read will put the fixed length header into your first buffer, and then your data into the second buffer. So it's pretty handy. It's all in a single OS call, so that's pretty efficient too. So performance-wise, since it's so verbose and fancy, we were a bit wondering initially, and basically, the first experiment was a bit hacky with an NIO2. We wrote a simple connector. The thing was about testing it, like benchmarking it, see how it performed. It's very garbage collection intensive, and it's really high level, but actually the performance was really cool. So how does it work? Well, we'll see about it. Basically, there are a lot of optimizations that Sun did internally to make it work well. So SSL. So basically, we have to do encryption now. It's painful. So how does it work? Basically, it's the same as for NIO. It uses the SSL engine that was introduced for NIO. As with NIO, it's not compatible with the legacy JSSC. It doesn't use the old API, so same. The problem is that the use patterns of the SSL engine are a bit different. So if you write your old SSL engine like we did for OpenSSL, you find new bugs. That's really cool because it's hard to debug then. You have some stuff, some random use case failing for NIO2, it's working with NIO. It's the opposite sometimes also, so that's very funny to debug. All right, actually, that SSL glue code you have to write to talk to the SSL engine is more complex than the equivalent code for NIO, since basically you have those two different IO semantics. You have async calls and the blocking calls, and they all need to talk to the SSL engine a bit differently. So basically, you have to write twice as much code as we did for NIO. So the difficulty with that is that, well, it's SSL, so basically when you write stuff from your application, you may not produce network data. That's kind of easy to deal with, no problem. The most difficult problem is that when you read stuff from the network, it may not produce application data. And then it doesn't fit well with the fact that, for example, a blocking code must produce data for the application. So basically, you just did a network read that was blocking, didn't produce data, so you have to basically read again. It adds all sorts of complexity and edge cases, and it's really annoying. And it's twice as annoying since, you have to write the difference for the async call with the completion handler and the blocking code with the call with the future. So, and actually, all that is really boilerplate code. If you have some trying to write some server or client or whatever, you also have to write the same, mostly the same SSL implementation. It will duplicate all the code that we just wrote in Tomcat. So you can reuse some Tomcat code there, I guess. But it's really a pain. And basically, the point I'm trying to make is that this asynchronous channel, asynchronous socket channel implementation you have to write, basically, it should have been in core NIO2. I guess they didn't do it because NIO doesn't have it, but since it's even harder for NIO2, I think they should have done it. So that's kind of painful. So in addition to that, we found some problems with using NIO2. Okay, so basically the main big problem that we run into is that the state after an IO call is not really fully known, except when you get a future, because you know the result when the get returns, it's blocking, so you know if it failed or not. If you for the async calls, basically you have multiple states that are possible. It's not explicit since the read and write operations, they don't return any state or anything. So basically you could have an operation that's done immediately. It actually completed what I say inline, that means it completed in the context of the calling thread. Basically you call a read, it has data already in its internal buffer. Puts your data, NIO2 puts that data into your buffer, done. Or basically, it could still be done, but like the data wasn't immediately available, it completed fast enough. So in that case, NIO2 did spawn a thread, and it completed concurrently with your code, because obviously the read call wasn't blocking, so. And in that case, it needs a sync. I have a diagram later on that will make that more explicit. Also, in case some operation takes longer, like for example a big write or a read where no data was available, then the operation becomes pending. When an operation is pending, you can't attempt the same operation again, like if a read is pending, you can't read again. If a write is pending, you can't write again. If you do, it throws an illegal state exception. Actually, it's a a class that extends an illegal state exception, either read pending exception or write pending exception. Okay, so due to the unknown operation state, you have synchronization. As you could see, if it completes in line, you only have one thread. Again, I have the diagram right after. And in that case, it can be sometimes optimized. Also, you have to be careful with that synchronization, as I will see, because you can easily create a deadlock. So, basically, the two main scenarios you have, as I said, you do your read and write call, and then it has either it had some space in the write buffer, or it had data inside the read buffer, then it will immediately call the completion handler in the same thread. So the IO loop I wrote here is if the operation isn't complete. Like, for example, you gave an IO2 a buffer to write. It's the same as an IO. Basically, the operation is complete as soon as it wrote some stuff. It could be half your buffer. Usually, that's a problem because usually when you give a buffer to some IO stuff, you expect it to write fully. Like, you don't expect to write half the buffer. So in that case, in some cases, you need to have an IO loop. Basically, the IO loop is that the completion handler will call write again. So be careful here. You shouldn't put your synchronization inside the IO loop, because otherwise, it could well deadlock. We'll see about that when it's not in line. And so as you see, the code that is immediately following the read or write call inside your code is the do something else, and it will still be called in the same thread. So basically, the sequence will be read, completion handler, and then the rest of your code. So if the operation didn't complete immediately, then it's completely different. You'll have your main thread, your read or write call, which is non-blocking. So then you go to the rest of your code, and it's a do something else, whatever. So when the operation completes, it will actually complete in another thread. So the other thread will be calling completion handler. So since there are two threads, and your do something else might be manipulating the buffer you gave to the completion handler, well, you need to sync. So that's pretty different. And same as the other, if the operation is incomplete, in most cases, you'll enter a loop to have it complete, like read more data, write again. So again, here, since you have two threads, at least two threads, because the IO loop can spawn more threads, actually. So if you have some sync here, you mustn't include the IO loop inside the sync, because otherwise, it could spawn another thread and deadlock with your code that is still synced with the completion handler. So that's not going to be cool. So basically, if you redo a read and write call, you'd need to put it outside of your sync. All right. So completion handler behavior, in some cases, it's also sometimes a problem. As you can see, it could call the completion handler, tell it, oh, I'm done. I wrote one byte of your data. That's very helpful. Thank you. So that's needless completion handler calls, obviously, because then your completion handler will probably attend the operation again, and it's called call again the completion handler. That's not very cool. So it may force recursion, and then you probably mix some I/O with some logic as well, and so it's more complex. It's annoying. So you have to fix all that. Also, another problem with an IO2, I don't know why they did it, but basically the read and write calls that return the future object, they don't do vectoring. Basically, you can only give it one buffer in that use case. I have no idea why they did that, because internally, if you look at the internal implementation of an IO2, it's all wired up. Basically, everything is a read and write call that returns a future and accept vectoring. So they could have done it, but they didn't. So that's a problem to me, but well, whatever. Okay, so miscellaneous problems, which are pretty interesting, especially the second one. So you have a very aggressive buffering with an IO2. Basically, it's more aggressive than an IO. And basically, it could take longer to detect a network or connection problem, like if you pull a plug. Well, NIO2 will say everything's fine for quite a while, actually. And that behavior, it can cause what I call phantom timeouts on slow connections. Basically, if you have a giant buffer and you write it, if you have a slow connection that slowly reads it, basically, it will take so long to empty the buffer that actually the operation timeout could be triggered. Like, for example, if you have a connection that reads 100 kilobytes per second and a 2 megabyte buffer, which is what NIO2 often does, well, the default 20-second connection that it often used will trigger a timeout in that case. So that's not what you want. So you have to be careful about timeouts. Thankfully, with NIO2, the timeout is very explicit. It's per operation. It's not per connection. This way, you can adjust the timeout to the size of your buffer, basically, so that you don't run into big problems. Also, NIO2, it's very high level. It takes your train thread pool and owns it and abuses it and, well, basically destroy it. So you have to use a good thread pool, preferably the default from the JVM is good, but not something too fancy or blocking or queuing blocking or whatever that could be doing strange stuff afterwards. So since it abuses thread pools, it should be cheap. And buffers, well, it's the same. Basically, very often, since it's asynchronous, you have to give it a buffer you just allocated and basically give the API your buffer and not try to reuse it, because you can only reuse the buffer once the operation is complete and it's going to complete asynchronously inside your completion handler, basically. And then that's only at this point that you can reuse your buffer. If you try to reuse it, basically it's a lot more complex. So I think the main strategy in that case that, you should consider your buffers pretty cheap. So extending it. So with all that in mind, with all these problems, basically writing the code with the NIO2 code, it was too complex and, well, it wouldn't look very pretty. And so I decided to try extending it a bit to have better semantics and something which would produce better Tomcat code in the end. So the first thing that I didn't like is the pending exceptions all over the place. It's a common case scenario. And I don't think you should use exception routing for a common case scenario. You should instead get a status or whatever that there's an operation pending. You should try later, basically. At least you shouldn't catch for that. I don't see it, so. So instead, it's replaced the read and write calls, which now will now return an operation state, which will clearly indicate if it's an operation that an operation was pending. This way, it made the code flow a lot simpler, because basically we get an operation state object, there's a if else. So if something is pending, well, forget it. Otherwise, continue or whatever. But it's a lot better than having your code do a try-catch just for that. So we wanted more flexibility also. We needed to integrate with the socket wrapper manage buffers. Basically, the socket wrapper manage a per connection buffer for ease of use, basically with the other with the semantics of the regular I/O, which is blocking or whatever. It's useful to have this buffer, and it would be a pain to try to manage it yourself. Instead, for example, when you do a write with NIO2, it will try to flush. It will actually flush the socket wrapper buffer before doing the write with your buffers. It's all transparent, so basically you don't have to deal with that complexity. But otherwise, when upgrading to the protocol, basically the upgrade preface would be always a problem with that, and it will add complexity to the upgrade protocol. The upgrade and handler would have to deal with it, so that wasn't very nice. So another thing that was pretty annoying was the fact that everything's non-blocking and asynchronous with an AO2, and sometimes it's not ideal. In many cases, what you actually want is wait for the pending operation to clear and then do your operation. So that's what I call semi-blocking. Basically, it's not really blocking I/O, but still a bit. You also have true blocking I/O with your completion handler just for completeness and big convenience in some cases, like for HTTP2. That was very handy to have that. Basically, it's real blocking I/O. The completion handler call will only the read and write call you're making will only return when the completion handler has been called. In that case, well, obviously, you don't need to sync or anything, since it's already all everything will be serialized. And you have the regular NIO2 behavior, which is non-blocking. But if an operation is pending, instead of the pending exception, you'll get a not done completion state. So the operation state that will be returned when calling the IO operation, so you read or write, you get that operation state. You get pending. If the operation is not done, it will not complete in line, it will call your completion handler later. Okay. Not done. If you use non-blocking, and an operation was already pending. Well, in many cases, you don't need to reattempt your operation again. Basically, what it could mean is that you had a read going on, and you try another read because that way the design could be simpler. It will just return not done, but you can expect that you have another read going on, and it will read your data later. So you don't need to reattempt a read, basically. There's already a read going on. And it made my life a lot easier for HTTP2 in particular. So very helpful to have that. So inline, that means that the operation is done completely immediately. You don't need to sync in that case. Since you get the explicit inline flag completion state, you don't need to sync. You could add an if inline, then don't sync, else sync. That's pretty helpful to improve performance. So you get an error if the completion state was called with an AO exception or a timeout or whatever. It's explicit now. You don't have to set a flag back or whatever. And done means the operation is done, but it doesn't complete in line. Basically, it completed concurrently in a weird timing thingy, and it returned done. That can happen. In that case, you need to sync. So that operation state allows differentiating all the scenarios, all the trading scenarios. And this way, you can optimize your either your completion handler core or your synchronization. Pretty handy. So next, what we saw, which was a big problem, at least as far as I'm concerned, is the completion handler call control. Basically, you want your completion handler to be called only when your operation is really complete. So in most cases, that's what we do in an IO2 with HTTP2. You have an HTTP2 frame you want to write. Well, you want to write the whole frame. It needs to be wrote in a block. You can't have half a frame and half a frame of another stream inside your frame. It would corrupt the connection. So basically, you have to make sure your frame is written. So in that case, you have the I/O loop I talked about. So to avoid writing that I/O loop yourself, you have a completion check object now. Basically, it will check the state of the... It allows checking the state of the buffers, and then you can see if your operation is really complete. Basically, when writing, you can say, did I write all my data? Is there basically no bytes remaining in the byte buffers, right? And when, yeah.
Are the frames, say, HTTP2, are the frames big size or different?
No, it's basically the HTTP2 frames. There's a frame header, which is a 9-byte fixed size. And then you have a payload size, which is some payload up to a maximum. Mark will say if I say something stupid, if he'll complain. Said something stupid, it's not that. Well, so basically you have two, for HTTP2, what we do is we use two buffers for that reason. You have the 9-byte header and then the payload size header, the payload size buffer. Basically, with vectoring, you can handle the two buffers. So, So when you read, basically, the completion check will allow you to see if you wrote your whole content, basically. You probably know what to expect, and you see, for example, hey, I read only half my content, calling the completion handler, and the rest of my code is going to be useless. I need to read again. So you just return value, the completion check, you return continue, and it will read again, basically. It's pretty handy. So you can say, basically, continue, or you're done. If you're done, the completion handler is called. Basically, also, if there's an error, if you detect an error, it's still done. The completion handler error will be called then. There are some utility completion checks for common cases, and the common case is basically on write. You want to write the whole data, basically. So the utility completion check will loop until the buffer is empty. Yeah, wrong side. Okay, so now the extended API. Now it's two read and write methods that slightly extends the NIO2 async vector API. So it adds three things actually. It adds the blocking mode parameter with different blocking modes I talked about, the completion checked parameter, which is an object you provide, and that will allow checking if your operation is complete or not. Then it returns the completion state value, which is an enum. I described the various values, and this completion state is also passed to the completion check call. Why does it pass it to the completion check? Because you don't have any other way to pass it otherwise. It's useless plumbing code. And also because NIO2 API is a completion handler, we can't modify that API. And the completion check object is the main way to pass the completion state to the completion handler if you need it. So there's also an addition on the socket wrapper, which is the internal main object in Tomcat, which represents a connection. It indicates if the NIO2 async API is available. Basically, it will only be available if you're using the NIO2 connector. I tried to implement it on NIO, but unfortunately, it's a bit like implementing an NIO framework on top of NIO, and a lot of people already did that. So it's pretty useless to try to do it again. So if you want the whole detail on the extended API, you have to see the Tomcat Java doc. I hope it's well documented, right? It's well documented. We are good at documentation. It's all well known. Oops. So the missed items that we couldn't do in that extension, the future IO calls with vectoring, unfortunately, it's not doable. Basically, you would need to be inside the NIO2 implementation, and internally, they actually did it, so it's pretty easy, but fortunately, it's not possible to get synchronization right to do it ourselves. So for blocking, there's no vectoring. It's still the same single buffer read and write calls. So the threading strategy isn't directly controllable either, it's the same. Of course, since you use the completion check, your application will be exposed to only, your code will only be exposed to a more limited amount of threads. There's less concurrency normally. So the buffering strategy, it's basically the same, it remains the same black box. Also, as I said, you can't pass the completion handler, it's NIO2, so we can't modify it to pass the completion check object, the completion state. It's not that, that's right. I made a mistake. It's the completion state object directly to the completion handler. So if you want to know the operation state, you need to have your completion check pass the completion state to the completion handler. Okay, so how we did it in Tomcat? How we use NIO2 now? So the API is available on the socket wrapper. That's the main object representing a connection. All connectors in Tomcat have access to the socket wrapper. They use it to read and write data, basically. So privilege Servlet API upgrade handlers like HTTP HTTP protocol handler, right? No, it's HTTP upgrade handler, right? The name of the class for the Servlet API. Yeah, something like that. So HTTP upgrade handler. If you give it a privileged version of that object, which is internal HTTP upgrade handler, the Servlet Tomcat will give you the Servlet wrapper instance. Once you get that, you check the NIO2 API availability using the flag I added, and then you can use the new NIO2 calls. The status, how we used it in Tomcat in practice. So it's used in the HTTP2 and WebSocket protocol handler. HTTP2 is a really truly internal core protocol handler. It's almost the same footing as an HTTP 1.1, but WebSockets, actually, it's more implemented inside the application layer. So if you were to try to use an IO2 inside your application, as we'll see just a bit later, WebSockets is the thing to look at. Overall, it's much simpler IO code. Well, it's pretty compact now, but pretty cool. So we did try to use async IO vectoring too. So what we did is for the frame input in HTTP2, now it's non-blocking instead of being blocking. That's always handy, why not? And it also uses vectoring. That is, basically, we pass two buffers at the same time to the OS. The first 9-byte buffer for the frame header, and then another bigger buffer for the framed payload data. And then the OS kindly puts all the requested frame header pre-parsed into our cool small buffer. It's pretty cool. We have a completion check code, which I'll show if I have time. We'll see. So it's also used for WebSocket message output. And also, there's an equivalent of send file for HTTP2. And it's done using map files. Actually, I was very impressed by the performance of that thing. So it's amazing, really. Basically, the difficulty of using HTTP2 send file was that since it's all framed, even though you have to write a static file, you have to decorate all frames with your frame header. Basically, you have to slice your static file otherwise, and that way it wasn't done. So with that vectored writes, basically, you can give it a portion of your mapped file with the right header, and you give those two buffers to the OS, and it directly writes them. Since mapped files is a direct buffer, basically it's the same as a send file. It's a zero copy write for HTTP2, and it does the same as a real send file. So that's pretty cool. So I have an example which I recommend looking at. For frame input, like async vectored input, you can look at the HTTPS2 async parser. I have like 15 minutes left. I'll go back if I have time. I don't think I'll have time. But you should have a look at it for input. So how you can use now NIO2 in your web apps, we'll have a look at WebSockets. So what you do is you would upgrade from HTTP2 using the Servlet 3.1 API. You call upgrade with your HTTP upgrade handler. That was the right class name, cool. But instead, you give it an internal HTTP upgrade handler. It's very simple to write. It's only a few extra methods, which you probably don't care about. The method you care about is a set socket wrapper on the internal HTTP upgrade handler. It just gives us the socket wrapper instance. And with that instance, you can actually read and write your byte buffers directly. So an example of an internal HTTP upgrade handler. So you have that important thing, that SSL support. Well, it's important also, right, Christopher? All right. So that's the init. And then we just do a broken write here, these hello bytes. And we say we want to do a full write instead of just writing age. So we want to make sure hello is fully written. And so that's what a write call will look like now. I put it in the init method since it was easy, but well, you can do it elsewhere, asynchronously, whatever. Once upgraded, you can do anything anyway, so.
So this changes the API for WebSockets now? Is it
there's an alternate for a WebSocket now for writing. There's an alternate code path which uses these write calls instead of the regular socket wrapper write calls, which go through the internal socket wrapper buffer. Basically, it removes a layer of buffering. The whole thing basically is that now the trendy APIs, like I don't know if you follow the graphics APIs news, there's this new API called Vulkan instead of OpenGL. And basically, OpenGL is that the container manages everything, buffer, state, whatever, threading. Vulkan, you own the buffers, you own everything, you can do efficiently if you want, but you can also really mess things up. But the thing is that the container does a lot less, and this way it can be more efficient in some cases. The whole point is efficiency, really. So I think Vector.io, it can be useful in your applications. If you do IO-intensive tasks, like, for example, as I said, you can replicate send file-like performance in your apps. If you want to write big media big media files or whatever, it's very efficient. It's excellent if you have a true fixed-length binary protocol. WebSockets, HTTP2, they are not true fixed-length binary protocol. Only the frame header is a fixed-length buffer. But in some cases, like for example, Ethernet, well, it's all fixed length. So you can have a lot of fun with that. Basically, we can reuse buffers and do all your parsing with IO vectoring and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty cool. So with that, you can do pretty cool integration of low-level protocols. Obviously, HTTP2 and WebSockets aren't very low-level, but, well, you could do it for even lower level things. So you could replicate send file-like performance really efficient. So as I said, it messes up with the buffer strategy you were used to. Before you had a buffer at the servlet layer, you also had a buffer at the container layer. If you use that API, you don't have any buffering at all. You own the buffer, your buffer will be written directly. So what you can do now is actually use direct buffers instead of regular buffers, especially if you find a way to reuse them. Because this way, basically the buffer will go straight from the servlet layer to the network or to the SSL layer because we encrypt everything. And so the SSL layer, actually what it does, it really likes having direct buffers. If you give your SSL engine a non-direct buffer, the first thing which it will do is allocate a direct buffer and copy your bytes to the direct buffer. So if you have a direct buffer that you'll reuse, it will perform much better. That's also why using map files was so efficient with HTTP2. Basically, we had a map file is a direct buffer, so we gave the direct buffer to the SSL layer, so it's as efficient as it could be, basically. Instead of going through with a static file to the servlet buffer, the container buffer, allocate a direct buffer, and encrypt. So that's straight from the file to the encryption. So that was nicer. Also, it's only for protocol upgrades. Well, obviously, if you are still in HTTP mode, your data still has to be framed, either with chunked encoding, usually with HTTP 1.1, or with HTTP2 framing and multiplexing. So you can't write raw data straight to the socket. You have to frame, and if you don't want, basically, if you upgrade, you write raw data to the socket, and in that case, you can do whatever you want. Okay, so we have an example here as well. It's a WebSocket message output. That's straight output, and since WebSocket lives in the application layer, we would typically write the same thing. So I actually have some time, so maybe I'll click on the link, see if it works. All right. Yay, it worked. All right. Oh, it's too small. Oops. Okay, that looks good. Can you see or should it be a bit bigger? Okay, so basically when you write stuff with WebSockets, it's vectored kind of. So the write does pass a set of buffers. And so the addition is that you check has async IO on socket wrapper. If it says true, that means you're using the NIO2 connector, okay. So in that case, well, that block thing is just to compute some timeout. It's not very useful. Okay, so then you would do a write. It's pretty easy. You have the block flag. If it's in blocking mode, I'll use a true block write. And if it's not a blocking mode, I'll use a semi-block. Why do I use a semi-block for a non-blocking write? It's just in case, because if not, I'll get a pending exception or the operation won't be, the data won't be written, which should be bad. And normally, there shouldn't be any concurrency in WebSockets. And so it uses semi-block here. And so I use a utility completion check, which says I want to write the whole data, basically, since, well, it's a WebSocket message. So let's write it fully. And with completion means it should call the completion handler. So my completion handler here, it's pretty simple. Computes the timeout to see if it did timeout or not, because the WebSocket's timeout is a bit complicated. It's external. It has to be, well, it's pretty plumbing. And then it unregisters the timeout if it's complete, and then it's done, basically. So basically, we replaced, as I'll show, we have only one write call, and that's it, basically, to write WebSockets. Otherwise, you have to juggle with the onwrite possible of the Servlet 3.1 API and also duplicate some write code here, which also does some writing here. Yeah, sets the write timeout, then flush, then whatever. And also the onwrite possible was doing the kind of the same thing, like writing again if it's not complete or whatever. All that complexity, it's all taken care of now in a single call. Here. The completion handler is just for completing, for checking the timeout and doing some WebSockety thingy. So it's much simpler now. Okay, back to the presentation. Please go back. Oh no, it didn't go. Oh. Stupid. There. Conclusion. Okay, so I'm pretty happy with the end result in the end. Had good performance. And also, since it's asynchronous, reactive APIs might be easier to implement. We'll see about it, what they look like. But the thing is that in IO2, basically, you only get a callback if you actually did something. You won't get a callback otherwise. Basically, if you get your completion handler completion call, for example, it's because you read or wrote something. If you don't try to read something, then you're not getting any callback. So that means if you don't want to get back pressure, you don't call read. No problem. You don't have to suspend or resume anything. Okay, and I'm done. Any questions? Okay, all looks good. Time for lunch. Lunch, do you want me to go back to the... Well, I have like 5 minutes. You want me to go back? Oh. Well, if you, okay, and the question is about the benefits of vectored I/O, basically. Well, if you want to write multiple buffers, it happens sometimes, you can do it in a single operating system call. Instead of, like, say you want to write 4 buffers, well, regularly you have to do 4 OS calls, then maybe a flush, who knows. And with vector DIO, you replace that with a single core, which will write four buffers at the same time. Even if they're not contiguous memory or whatever, the OS deals with that and it works. And it can be zero copy in some case too. So that's pretty cool, I think.
The performance is the same on Windows as it is on Linux?
I didn't try. I didn't try it. I do all my testing in Linux. Others do testing on Windows, so we'll see if I get feedback. On Linux, I noticed it's about, like, on a single core, usually, it can write up to 64 kilobytes of data in a single core. Pretty cool. Yes, Christopher.
You mentioned that you can only use this for upgraded protocols.
Yes. Okay, so the question is that is it only for upgraded protocol, and can you use it for servlet async? No, you can't use it for servlet async. It's only for upgraded protocol, since you read and write raw data on the socket. And if you use H2 or WebSockets, basically your raw data is decorated with frame headers or whatever. Basically, you get framing from the container, so you're trying to write raw data, the framing isn't going to be there. So you'll have to do it yourself. You can.
So you'd recommend, if you want to take advantage of this, you pretty much always have to write your I.O. code so that NIO2 is a special case, and if it's available, use it. If it's not available, there needs to be a fallback.
Yes, at the moment, yes. But, well, you know what you configure, so I guess if you're going to know if NIO2 is going to be available, right? Basically, if it's your own application, then if it's, for example, an open source application that is supposed to used by people, then you need two IO paths, yes. So yeah, it's more complex. So basically, it's for your own stuff, I think. Yes. Just a bit. It's only like 200 lines of code, so small. It's not a big framework, I mean.
Do you think, because earlier in your presentation you said these are features that the NIO2 API really shouldn't have, is there any movement with the JSR or anything like that to add any of these things, or is that something you'd be interested in doing?
I have no idea what they plan to do or if they would be interested. The thing is that the more rapid development process of the JDK maybe would make it possible to do an announcement. I don't know, it's a JIP or whatever. What do they call that? JEP, right? The announcement feature request or whatever, or like when they add a feature to the JDK. But now it's added very often, like every 6 months you get new features. I read the changelog, so maybe it's possible, yeah. Basically, they'll need to add the operation check is important, I think. The completeness of the operation, I think it's important. And yeah, having SSL out of the box in some way, because otherwise it's a nightmare. I mean, you have like 2,000 lines of code doing stupid things, like it should be boilerplate. It's pretty annoying. And we had tons of bugs, like with that stupid secure asynchronous socket channel. So it's the same with NIO, but as I said, it's even more complex. So,
one more question.
Yeah.
You write up here that has good performance.
Yes. No, all the metrics were good compared to NIO. Usually it's at least as fast or faster than NIO, so that's pretty good.
What about CPU usage, resource usage?
It's very garbage collection intensive. I didn't do any big garbage collection test. That could be a problem or not, depends. You'll have to test that, basically. Garbage collection is going to be the main thing, since it uses a lot more objects than NIO.
Can you describe the nature of those objects?
Well, all the completion handler and the buffers and stuff like that. Basically, the buffers Well, you could reuse them or not. It depends on your application, really. It's pretty hard to envision what's the use pattern, but since it's asynchronous, you have to be really, really careful when you're reusing buffers or even the completion handler. Basically, if you have a stateless completion handler, yeah, you can reuse it, no problem. But it's not always the case. It depends. So in most cases, it will be more resource intensive, but it's not nearly the same order of magnitude when you compare, for example, HTTP 1.1 versus HTTP 2. HTTP 2, it's really an order of magnitude more intensive for garbage collection. Here, it's only a couple really simple objects. It's free, basically. So, all right. Anything else, or are we done? I think I went over my allotted time or close, so I think it's time to go to lunch. Do you think lunch is going to be good? Okay. Thank you so much.